Hello and welcome to the Weekly News Roundup, a podcast of the Daily News. My name is Ann Brennan and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. Each Friday we discuss stories that made headlines. This week we'll talk about a bakery in business for 51 years calls it quits, Genzyme announces layoffs in Framingham, and a local school gets local schools get high marks from U.S. News & World Report. We start with a story about a group of Milford High School students whose quick action may have saved their teacher's life. Joining us on the phone to talk about this is Scott Calzaleo from our Milford Daily News office. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
So you spoke with the students and the teacher. What can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, so this story picked up steam very quickly. Other news outlets started picking it up as well after our initial story was put out. Former teacher and longtime substitute Dennis Jack Candini, he's 72 years old. He suffered a stroke on April 27th toward the end of the day while watching over a food service class. And once students noticed that the teacher was unresponsive, they kind of sprang into action. One went down to the nurse, one got the next door teacher, one was asking him questions. They noticed slurred speech. They immediately called first responders, and based off of what Jack told me, their quick action might potentially save his life.
Also, the quick action, I understand, with stroke, people suffering a stroke, the quicker they get medical care and get the medications that prevent, I guess they help dissolve a clot that may be causing the stroke, that it reduces the amount of damage that's done by when a stroke occurs.
Yeah, exactly. That's what Jack said. He says there's about a 1 to 2 hour window, depending on the person, that it could severely start to affect their motor functions for the rest of their lives. It could affect lots of other things, make them prone to more strokes. So the quick action, he said, he's in debt to them, is what he told me. He doesn't know how to repay them for the way that they reacted.
And I understand one of the students actually knew the symptoms of a stroke and kind of had a sense that this was what was going on.
Yeah, it was interesting. He had said on the phone with first responders that, "I think my teacher's having a stroke," and not having witnessed one in the past, only having seen TV depictions or reading about symptoms, was he able to diagnose that on the spot? Turns out he was right.
Well, that's a happy story. How is Mr. Candini recovering well?
Oh, he's doing great. He's hoping to get back to coaching the girls' softball league. He's also on a 70-plus hockey league that he's hoping to get back on the ice with. So, yeah, no, he's doing great, and he's very happy.
Well, in February, 24-year-old Benjamin Walsh, who grew up in Millis, was charged with the stabbing death of his girlfriend, Olivia Bergstrom, in the Needham apartment that they shared, and was stabbing his father and his mother in a Millis restaurant a few hours later. You were able to speak with Benjamin Walsh's father this week. Would you catch us up on this story and then tell us what the dad had to say?
So basically, Ben Walsh right now is at Bridgewater Correctional Facility. That's a facility where the father told me they put a lot of focus on mental health. They have a mental health facility right within their correctional complex. So they've been helping him out a lot. And basically, he'll be due back in court next month, late next month. And things will go on from there in terms of processes. But when I spoke to his father, the father was a little hesitant to talk at first, but he soon told me that his son was most certainly having a mental episode that day, and he was now just feeling sick about the situation, along with both of the parents. His father said Bergstrom, his girlfriend, was also his absolute best friend, and his mother is someone that Ben has adored his whole life. So his father told me that he, within his episode, hurt the two people he loved the most.
How's the mother doing? Last I knew, she was still in the hospital. We haven't really followed up on that in a while.
Yeah, she's home. When I walked up to the house, she was actually getting in a car and driving away with some others, and the father was still there. So she's up and around. The father told me she's recovering physically, but emotionally, it's been a daily struggle.
And I understand there are some fundraising efforts, or is a fundraising effort going on in Olivia Bergstrom's name as well.
Yeah, Primavera Restaurant is in the works of creating a fundraising effort for that. Whether it's going to be a scholarship fund or general fundraising for mental health, we're not quite sure yet.
And that's the restaurant where Benjamin is accused of stabbing his mother and father. Well, Scott, thanks for joining us.
No problem at all. Thank you.
Last week, there was a bizarre story about a man who stopped his car in the middle lane of the Mass Turnpike, got out, and tried to get onto a school bus behind him. We're joined now by Jim Hadadine to find out more about this. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You spoke with the bus driver's brother. What did he tell you?
So we got the inside scoop from the brother of Joe Rizzoli, who was driving the bus. The brother is Jim Rizzoli. The Rizzolis are probably familiar to many people in Framingham. They've been in the public eye for a little while, and one of them recently served as a town meeting member. So the story is that Joe Rizzoli drives a bus in for the public schools in Weston. He was dropping some Metco students back off in Boston, coming back on the Mass Pike, and apparently with no provocation, a guy in a red Toyota got in front of him, started driving erratically, stopped his car in the middle of the turnpike, got out, waved at him, yelled something about the windows being tinted, and then tried to get in the bus, and at one point was positioning himself on the hood of the bus during this whole conflagration, and then drove away. So Joe has, he had installed a dash cam in the bus, which I guess the Weston Public Schools are not super happy about, but this dash cam did capture some pretty extraordinary footage of this whole thing happening in the middle of moving traffic on the Mass Pike, which is not something that you see every day.
So the gentleman, I believe, from Dorchester has been charged in this case?
Yeah, the Massachusetts State Police summonsed him to appear in court. I'm not sure if he's been arraigned yet, but he has a variety of charges, motor vehicle charges, and I think disorderly conduct or something along those lines. And he has been interviewed by the Boston Herald, and I think one of the TV stations tracked him down too. And he, you know, assured everyone of his mental stability and just basically said he had some concern for the safety of kids who could be on a bus with tinted windows.
But stopping in the middle of the Mass Turnpike, I guess it outweighed his concern for the windows.
Right.
Moving on, one of the most popular stories this week on our website was about Angry Ham's liquor license being suspended for 5 days. What's behind that Framingham taking action against that business?
There was an incident on January 27th where apparently two guys get into a fight in the parking lot. The police allege that one of the two men pulled a knife, and upon seeing the knife, the other guy bit him in the face. Which is, you know, you can imagine that's a dramatic scene. So what actually got Angry Ham's in trouble was they did have a bouncer that was there. The bouncer broke up the fight, apparently, and people went their separate ways. But Angry Ham's did not contact the police department at that point. Under the city's bylaws, if there is some kind of situation that endangers public safety, a liquor license holder is required to contact the police department, and they didn't take that step. So the police only found out about it when the guy who was bitten in the face came down to the police department about an hour later and registered his unhappiness with the whole thing. And so the police went down there, talked to people, and documented a few other things that they see as violations of the liquor license, such as there were people there in the bar after closing time who were not employees of the business. Some of the servers didn't have the ID cards they're required to have. So the Board of License Commissioners took this up on Monday and agreed with the police department's recommendation to suspend the license.
Was this the new board's first action?
Well, they've done other things in terms of sanctioning someone, a license holder. I believe this was the first time that they've actually sanctioned somebody. And they definitely did their due diligence. This hearing lasted for more than an hour. There were attorneys from both sides. It was like watching a court case unfold, which is kind of more rigor than I've seen applied in some of the hearings that were conducted before by the Board of Selectmen. So they're definitely taking this responsibility seriously.
Well, Angry Hams, maybe they need to change it a little, maybe like Easygoing Hams or something.
Mellow Hams.
Well, you reported a story about Alira Health planning to double its laboratory space on Grant Street as it ramps up to research and development work. What does the company do, and how much space is it planning to add?
So this is not a business that I'm super familiar with, but they are located on the fourth floor, and they do kind of contract services for life sciences companies. I think some of their work involves doing clinical trials for people who pay them to kind of run the clinical trial end of things. They do have offices elsewhere in the U.S. and in Europe, so they've got a pretty expansive footprint. But in Framingham, they've got about 5,700 square feet of lab space now, and they would like to more than double that, bring it up to about 13,000 square feet of lab space.
Does that mean there's going to be more jobs as well?
One imagines. They acquired another company about 2 months ago that works in the same space and has certain expertise that they felt could kind of expand what they do. So I'm not sure if they're going to, if they're planning to move employees in there, this other company was in Framingham, or kind of what the long-term vision is, but it does seem like it's going to enhance, you know, their business activity in the city.
Speaking about local life sciences companies, I understand Sanofi Genzyme, which specializes in developing medications for rare diseases, announced some layoffs this week.
Yeah, one of our colleagues at the paper, Zane, had a story in today's paper about Genzyme's plans for their facility in Framingham. They have been working on this expansion for maybe 3 or 4 years, and it's really a huge investment in the technology park. It's something like $80 million. So that was a big deal for the city when they announced it a few years ago, and I think there was maybe this presumption that that would come with increased employment here in Framingham, but according to the company, they are streamlining their operations here. Which they do some research here, but I think they also do some manufacturing work. So I guess the outcome is, you know, they're going to have this new facility there, and it's going to require less human beings to do the work that needs to be done. So they've announced something like 95 layoffs for their local workforce.
Well, finally, Kevin O'Loughlin, who was convicted of raping an 11-year-old girl in the early 1980s, received a $5 million jury award, or ruling anyway, this week. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Yeah, pretty remarkable story. This guy, Kevin O'Loughlin, grew up in Framingham. He was 19 when he was arrested and charged with kidnapping and raping a young girl who lived about a mile and a half from his house. He served more than 3 years in prison, bounced around in different parts of the correctional system in Massachusetts, endured kind of, I think, the worst that the prison system has to offer, especially to someone who's arrested and charged with child rape. And after he was released, you know, obviously didn't find anything of benefit to staying in Framingham. So relocated to Texas, started a new life there, started a business, had a family, and kind of maintained his innocence throughout, but didn't file appeals against the case or things like that. But lo and behold, 3 decades later, former Deputy Chief Kevin Slattery, who was then a lieutenant at the police department, had a case come across his desk that involved a guy who had been charged and convicted in 1985 of raping a young girl in Framingham in circumstances that, in Kevin Slattery's mind, seemed to have some resemblance to what Kevin O'Loughlin had been convicted of. So he started piecing things together and saw a whole pattern of incidents involving this other gentleman that made him suspect that perhaps Kevin O'Loughlin was not the one who actually committed that crime in 1982, and it was this other guy who is now incarcerated in for totally unconnected things. And so he brought this to Marion Ryan's office, the district attorney in Middlesex County, apparently after an extreme amount of research and work to kind of vet this out. The DA's office decided to drop the charges, and so his name was cleared, but in Massachusetts, you can also sue under this new wrongful conviction law, which could get you some money from the state if you did time in prison, at least a year in prison for a felony crime. So he brought this lawsuit, and the town and several police officers who were involved in the case settled with Kevin O'Loughlin for $900,000 several months ago. That's money that's been paid by the town's insurance company. And then there was a jury trial over the last week and a half in Boston and Suffolk County Superior Court, which resulted in the jury finding in Kevin O'Loughlin's favor and awarding him $5 million. The jury isn't informed ahead of time that there is a cap on the amount of money that one can receive from the wrongful conviction statute. So the amount of money he will actually get is $1 million, but you know, pretty, you know, resounding message in his favor from the jury.
Right, and the reason he gets $1 million is because of the recently passed justice reform bill, criminal justice reform bill that upped that award from or cap from $500,000 to $1 million. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. After 51 years in business, the owners of a Milford bakery are calling it quits. Henry Schwan joins us in studio to tell us about this story, which was one of the most popular on the Milford website this week. Welcome, Henry.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So what can you tell us about the bakery?
Wow, 51 years. It all comes to an end this Sunday. And Ray and Dick's Bakery started in 1967 and by two brothers, Ray and Dick. And it's a history of bakers in this family. It goes back to Dick's father, who owned a bakery in Putnam, Connecticut, and Dick's two sons have operated the bakery since, I guess, the mid-80s, since their father, Dick, bought out Ray. And it's been gangbusters ever since. So people in Milford and the surrounding towns of Milford, they really have an affinity for this bakery. They really love it.
I know the pictures and video made me very hungry. I was craving pastry by the time I looked at that. But they're trying to sell the bakery, I understand.
I think for a number of reasons, Anne. I think they're tired. They get up every morning at 2 o'clock, and they have to get there probably up by 3, I'm assuming, or maybe earlier. And they open at 6 in the morning, and they're open till 1 o'clock, I believe, and 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and I think it's worn them down, and the brothers indicated they're not really sure what they're going to do next, but I think they're pretty sure that this is the right move to make. They think it's the right time.
They said that there's a lot of competition now from supermarkets that have bakery counters as well, so that was one of the reasons they were calling it quits.
Looking in that case, that display case of theirs, those supermarkets can't produce the same kind of whoopie pie. Good whoopie pies at Ray and Dick's Bakery, that's for sure.
Well, one thing they said, that if they do end up selling it, you get the property, but not the recipes.
Yeah, I guess those will probably go to the grave with the brothers. They are not going to give up those cherished recipes. They go back many generations, I believe, to their grandparents, maybe even further back. So I guess that sale price would be considerably higher if if those recipes were included, but they won't be.
Well, maybe we're going to see them on the Food Network or somewhere like that.
Maybe so.
We have links to the video and photos of the bakery with the show notes to this episode. Retirement seemed to be a theme for you this week, Henry. You had an interview with Linda Simpkins, who's leaving the life of soil, plants, and livestock for the beach.
You know, Anne, wouldn't it be nice if we could all just go to the beach and retire? But I guess we're not in a position at this moment to do that. But Linda Simpkins is. She's been there for 38 years, executive director of the Natick Community Organic Farm for all 38 years. And she said it's really time for her to go because she feels that the farm is in a good place financially. It has a 30-year lease with the town. The farm was owned, it's 27 acres approximately, and it was owned by the school department in Natick. But recently, that ownership transferred, it became conservation land into perpetuity. So she feels, and also when she started, she looked back on her earliest days, and the budget was $3,000, the annual budget, 38 years ago. It's now over $600,000. So she feels the town is committed to investing in the farm, the fact that it's now conservation land. She feels it's a really good time to step away.
It said that she had two of her own kids and one foster child that she raised on that farm. I guess that makes it even a little bit It's not that she's having a hard time leaving, but she said she was getting a little weepy thinking about it.
Yeah, a little weepy, which for her, just what struck me is that's not common for Linda Simpkins, because the way that she articulates her thoughts, she's very direct, she's very matter-of-fact. And you get the feeling that she sees life really in black and white terms. I mean, she's very confident in her decision making, and for her to be a little weepy, I thought, boy, that was really great that she admitted that. But yes, her two boys did grow up on the farm. They're adults now. And she did take in years ago a high school student who was friends with her children, and she helped raise that young woman who is now, I believe, in her 40s, lives in Holliston, and is a dog groomer. So not only has she done wonderful work on the farm, but she has helped out in many other ways as well.
So have they found a replacement for her yet?
Yes, they have. The current assistant director, I'm groping for his name. I know it's in the story. But I don't think it's a done deal. But if Linda has her way, he will take over. I think that's the succession plan.
You can see video and photos of Simpkins at work on the farm by following the links in the show notes with this episode. Thanks, Henry, for joining us.
Oh, sure, Ann. Thanks for having me.
In Massachusetts, there's a lot of pride when it comes to our education system and schools. So there was a lot of interest when the U.S. News & World Report published its list of best high schools, and Metro West and Milford area schools fared pretty well. Our director of multimedia, Caitlin Kelleher, has her finger on the pulse of this story is with us today. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hello. It's nice to be on this side of the mic today.
Right. Caitlin also edits and produces this, so she's doing triple duty now. So which local high schools received the highest rankings?
The charter school that is often known as AMSA around here, which is the Academy for Math and the Advanced Math and Science Academy, it was ranked number 2 in the state, right behind Boston Latin, which is an exam school. So that's a pretty good ranking. Hopkinton was ranked number 5 in the state, which is a great ranking. And then Dover Shoreburn rounded out the Metro West schools in the top 10, coming in at number 8. But there were a lot of Metro West schools and some Milford area schools that were on the list that for the top 100 in the state.
Do you know what the, first of all, the AMSA is located in Marlboro. And do you know what the criteria is that they use to do these rankings?
They look at a variety of pieces. The graduation rate is looked at on its own. College readiness is the other major piece that it looks at, which includes a variety of pieces that they release. It looks at AP scores, AP, number of APs offered in a school.
Well, thank you, Caitlin. And you can find a link to the list of local schools and where they were ranked with the notes, show notes of this episode. Authorities still have not identified a masked man and woman who robbed a Washington Street bank in Holliston at gunpoint in October, but they're now hoping a reward may help shake loose some information. Joining us now to talk about this is Norm Miller, our cops and beer reporter, also known as the Beer Nut. Welcome, Norm.
Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about this story?
Oh, basically, the FBI and Holliston police have gotten together. They're offering a $10,000 reward for any information to lead to the identification of the two suspects. I think they're hoping that maybe people know something, but they don't want to be a snitch, but $10,000 might entice someone to, I'll be a snitch. $10,000 is a lot of money. So I'm thinking they're hoping. They have a lot of good video, but, I mean, the suspects were both wearing masks, so they know one's a man and one's a woman, but other than that, they have video of a car they believe they used. We had them all on the Metro West Daily News .com this week, so you can go look at the photos. It has all the contact information. But, yeah, they're looking for these two suspects. They think the man might have been familiar with the operation of the bank because he knew exactly where everything was, jumped the counter, led them to the safe, no dye packs. The woman was armed with a revolver. And so they're hoping that maybe this $10,000 reward will maybe jog someone's memory.
They had pretty scary masks, at least the man did. And I'm wondering how someone goes in the bank dressed like that and nobody starts pushing buttons before they get to the counter.
Well, I mean, they went in around, if I remember correctly, around 1:30 in the afternoon. Maybe the tellers are busy. I guess there's a staircase leading up to the thing. So they went up and they went directly straight to the counter. They didn't dilly-dally or anything like that. They just walked straight to the teller. The man started screaming right away about no dye packs, don't press the alarm, and jumped over the counter. The woman had the gun out within seconds and kept saying, hurry up. So I think it was really just looked from the description that these people went in with a purpose. It wasn't like you hear a lot of bank robberies where the people are wandering around, looking around, making sure no one's paying attention, looking for stuff. They went straight in, right to the teller, and did it right away.
Well, that sounds pretty harrowing. So $10,000 if you have information. And there's a link to the story, Norm's story, and with the photos, with the show notes of this episode. You attended a promotion ceremony for the Framingham Police this week, which the Framingham Police recently lost their police chief to retirement. Who was promoted?
They promoted two new deputy chiefs, Victor Pereira and Lester Baker. They joined Deputy Chief Ron Brandolini, who got moved to the executive officer, who's the second in charge of the department. The other deputy chief was Stephen Trask. He's acting chief, but, I mean, they promoted two deputy chiefs, including a replacement for him. So I'm guessing there'll be some announcement in the next few weeks. But so they have a new leadership team in place now.
And it looks like it's a diverse leadership as well. There's some diversity there.
Yeah, Lester Baker is the first African-American deputy chief in Framingham. Interestingly, he got promoted to sergeant at the same day as the first African-American lieutenant. He took the lieutenant's position as sergeant in 2008, so it's a good move. And Victor Pereira, he's a native-speaking Portuguese. So, as you know, Framingham has a large Brazilian population that speaks Portuguese. So it's a good, diverse promotion, but Trask made sure to point out that neither of them were based on that diversity. They earned their things for their work. I know Victor Pereira in the last year just got a law degree. He's been going to school, a lot of training. Lester Baker was a member of the SWAT team. He was a shift commander. He was a motorcycle officer. He's been around forever. I mean, so they've both been on the force for a while, and they both have worked their way through the ranks over the years.
So what's new on the beer front?
Well, there's a lot of new things, but I'll concentrate. Treehouse Brewing Company out in Charlton and Monson, they're probably the most sought-after brewery in the country. Last year, they had a gigantic expansion. They moved from a small brewery in Monson and opened in Charlton. This week, they announced even more ambitious plans. They're going to add 16,000 square feet to the brewing and the retail area. They're adding outdoor seating areas. They're opening a 3-mile walking trail on their property. They announced they're going to be 60% green energy within 3 years, 100% green energy within 5 years. Their goal is to basically try to make better customer experience as well as be good community neighbors. They've been growing a lot. I think they opened in 2011. This is probably the sixth expansion, but there is no other brewery. They're open 5 days a week, and every single day you go there, from opening to close, there's a line of people waiting to get beer. And I've met a lot of brewers, and there's probably like five or six brewers or brewery owners that I have to say that when they talk about beer, the passion really comes through. And when you talk to Dean Rowan, one of the co-owners, and Nate Laney, the other co-owner, when they talk about beer, when they say their beer is the best, it's not just marketing. They honestly believe it. And there's not a lot of brewers, I say that, but they really do. And I think they're doing their best to try to keep the beer the same quality as well as making the experience great for the people that come to visit.
Well, I like the idea that you can drink a beer and then walk off the calories.
Yeah.
Norm, thanks for joining us. Nope. The weather has finally warmed up and summer's on its way, which means new offerings on the arts and entertainment scene. Joining us to talk about this is our arts and entertainment editor, Nancy Olson. Hello, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Ann. Hi, Caitlin.
So what are some of the must-go arts and entertainment events this summer?
Well, I'm really looking forward to the Boston Calling Music and Film Festival. They have a lot of really cool acts this year, and I think this is the second year they'll have it at the Harvard Athletic Complex in Alston. It used to be at City Hall Plaza, which was kind of squishy, and it was all brick there and everything. And so this year, the big acts are... On Friday, they're having The Killers, who I really love. I don't know if you guys know about them. They're from Las Vegas. And then Saturday, Jack White is the big headliner. Everybody knows him, right? From the White Stripes.
So that's in May?
That is. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. It's Memorial Day weekend. Yes. And on Sunday, the big act is Eminem, which is really pretty cool for Boston to have him here. So I'm really looking forward to going to all that. And last year, there were like a few kinks, people said, like it rained, so that was kind of stunk. But I think hopefully we'll cross our fingers that we'll have good weather so we won't have so much mud this year.
So are there other things that beyond that, later in the summer or as the summer goes on?
Well, something happening pretty soon is May 21st, the Elliot Norton Awards, where all the local theaters, it's like the Tony Awards for Boston. And the guest person this year is Randy Rainbow, and he's like an internet sensation who has some really funny videos if you want to check him out. But it's a really fun night. There's some entertainment there. And one thing that's really nice they're going to be doing is Robert Eagle, who's the founder of Waltham's Regal Music Theater of Greater Boston. They're going to be presenting him with a special award, and they're celebrating 50 years, so that's really nice for them.
So is there going to be a red carpet glamour portion to this?
I don't know. I've never been to it, but this year I'm going to go. I think it'll be really cool.
You can report back to us on
okay,
that.
Okay, I'll let you know. You just want to go to the red carpet like we did at that film festival. That's why you're asking me that, right?
Yes.
Yes. Well, if we need to dress up, I'll let you know, okay?
Okay.
And... Broadway in Boston is bringing some nice musicals this year. It's been a long time since my girls were little, and I sewed them Aladdin costumes for Halloween, but that's like the big musical for the summer, and I'm looking forward to seeing that. And also Motown the Musical, which I have seen before. That was really good. I would recommend that. And the Book of Mormon was hilarious. If you haven't seen that, it's really funny. It's really off color, though, so if that's not your thing. And they're all at the Boston Opera House. And those are all coming before Hamilton is coming, and everybody's, like, freaking out about that. Everybody wants to see that, of course, and that's in September.
Are there tickets available, or have they gone on sale yet?
They have gone on sale yet, and... I think if you are a member of Broadway in Boston, you get like first dibs on those. So this with the subscriptions and all. So what else is happening over closer to home? The Wellesley Repertory Theater is doing a play called A Piece of My Heart. And that's interesting because it is portraying six women who went to Vietnam, mostly nurses, but one country western singer. So that sounds fun. We don't see women portrayed too much in war stories. Usually that's about men. So that's kind of cool. And also more locally, the Center for Arts in Natick on May 18th is bringing Jefferson Starship. Remember them?
Yes. Yes, I do remember them. I think my sister had their records.
Grace Slick is of course, not going to be there. And also, I thought at Amazing Things, there's a comedian named Amy T, and she's coming May 16th. And she had a battle with depression and alcoholism, and she's overcome that and uses that in her comedy. And they're bringing her there for Mental Health Awareness Month. So.
And you have other things that you have, are highlighting on your summer preview that was published earlier this week. So we will have links to that with the show notes. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anne.
One final note. Follow the links in our show notes to see the Daily News Winter Sports High School All-Stars. We do this every sports season, and they will be up online. There's many sports that we covered, and I always like to highlight the high school kids. Thank you for listening to the Weekly News Roundup. You can find links to the stories, photos, and videos we spoke about with this episode's show notes. Thank you to Caitlin Kelleher for producing and editing this episode. Be sure to listen to the Daily News podcast on Tuesday with host Caitlin Kelleher. You can find the podcast in the Apple Store, Google Play, and on our website, MetroWestDailyNews.com and MilfordDailyNews.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next week.